At the Foot of the Cross, a monthly podcast from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.
Hello, everybody, and a very warm, I think warm's the word for this heatwave season that we're having as well. Warm welcome to At the Foot of the Cross, our monthly podcast, bringing you all the very latest from the Secretariat of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Sitting opposite me, you will be delighted to hear, is Abbot Hugh Allen, our Director of Mission. Abbot Hugh, how are you?
I'm great, thank you, James.
See what I did there?
And yeah, no, I was impressed by that, actually. Yeah, it was really good, you know. I think it's a bit presumptuous to think people are delighted, but I'm happy that you think that. That's really good.
No. They are.
You know, but yeah, but it's lovely to be with you again.
You're a talented chap. Now, we've got plenty to talk about. We will be having August off. I'll come on to that. We always have a bit of downtime.
Oh, great. Oh,
a little bit of downtime. You're off the hook.
Isn't God good?
God
is good.
God is good in all ways, but particularly during August.
Absolutely.
Month off in August. But for July, much as we are clattering through July, there's a lot to talk about. I think the first thing, Abbot Hugh, would be assisted suicide, because the private members bill, the terminally ill adults end of life bill, bit of a mouthful, is back in Parliament. It is sort of, if you like, in the form it was in before, which we had great problems with. Obviously, we're against the bill in principle. I think I need to make that very clear. But also, the content of that bill, we certainly considered to be dangerous.
Yes.
So, problems with that. It is back. It's in the House of Commons. We believe it will have its second reading and vote on Friday, the 11th of September. It is a private members' bill, which, hence the Fridays. Now, what we want people to do is quite clear. Catholics and people of goodwill, please do contact your MP. Even if you have before, we'd ask you please do so again. There's a really easy mechanism on our website, Bishops Conference website, cbcew.org.uk. And we're using a simple web form provided by Right to Life UK, the charity, very good charity. And literally just a few minutes, you can take the sample text, you can amend it so it obviously represents what you yourself want to say to your MP. Probably best to keep it short and snappy and make your voice heard. But do please do that. It's really important. Obviously, we stand for the dignity of human life from conception to natural death. That's where we situate ourselves. And we believe, you know, it's an alternative model for us. Care till the very last breath. That's what we believe we can do. It's what many of our care homes, many of our hospices provide. In fact, Abbot Hugh, segueing onto this, the Little Sisters of the Poor. I went to St. Peter's residence in Vauxhall.
Yes, you said.
And I know you obviously know the religious very well with your role as well. And that was where Pope Benedict went in 2010.
He did,
People will remember, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, he did.
I saw the curtains of the hall and I remembered the blessed Mrs. Faskey, lovely Mrs. Faskey. Apparently she only died like a year or so ago at 103 or 104.
Wow, gosh,
so there
isn't that
you
fantastic?
Go. So that is care to the last breath.
No, they're fantastic. And they're a good example of actually what we're meant to do as Christians is, you know, that's our fundamental task in our humanity, not just as our Christians, but in our basic humanity, is to care for people right up until the end and to give them that opportunity. And, you know, I think one of the things you're saying about the assisted suicide bill coming back, you know, there can be a slight feel perhaps now of, oh, here we go again, you know, here it is again. But we really need to be serious about this and not weaken in our determination to stop this, because it's not a religious issue. I think that sometimes people talk about that we're coming from it from a religious perspective. It's not. We're coming from it from a perspective as human beings. You know, it's fundamental to who we are as human beings that we respect the dignity of life. And if we can't do that, then, well, you know, our society, what are we bothering about? You know, it's we really need to take this seriously. So I can understand perhaps, you know, we think, oh gosh, it's back again. But it's really important, as you say, that people contact their MPs, that people take this seriously, that they raise that voice again for the common good of our brothers and sisters, and to do that just in our basic humanity. But I'm really glad, though, you got to see the Little Sisters. They are a fantastic community. I'm really privileged to know them quite well. They do so much beautiful work, and they do it with such humility and love. And they are an example of what we're meant to be about. And I think it's good to reflect on that we have these opportunities to care for those who are coming to the end of their life, because we believe as well that there is only one life. You know, we sometimes talk about eternity, but actually there's just one life. We go from our life here and now to our life in eternity, but it's all linked. it's all joined together, and that we enable each other to take that path in love and with as much care and with as much support as possible. And you see in the Little Sisters a real example of it writ large. So I'm glad you had a good experience there. And of course, following the footsteps of Pope Benedict, I remember one of the sisters there telling me about when the Pope was there, that there were some protesters screaming and shouting outside. And so this old sister started them singing Faith of Our Fathers.
Oh, beautiful.
To drown out the protesters. And actually, I thought that was really beautiful, that it is. It's the faith that we believe and that we love. And that's what we want to proclaim. So, you know, in our opposition to this, it's not because we're being naysayers, it's actually because we're being positive about the beauty of life.
And I think it's important to say as well that, you know, suffering, death, dying, it is a part of life, isn't it? And I think sometimes that's forgotten. You know, we try and postpone it to, you know, with every effort that we have. But it is, you know, you can, in 99.9% of cases, keep people very comfortable. You can show them that care. You can sit with them. Do you know what? I was really surprised in a way, and I have been in some really good hospices and care homes, but I'm still surprised, and this might be part of the problem. I expected to see sadder faces. I expected to smell a clinical environment. You sort of think this is going to be clinical. This is going to be sad. This is going to be you guys wait at the door. This is serious time. But what I was greeted with were smiling faces, a sense of peace and calm.
Yeah.
It's not a religious issue. That does come with our faith, but also comes with these beautiful places that work to keep things calm, gentle, reconciled.
I'd say a really good word actually is joy. Whenever I go to St. Peter's, the sisters' place, there's a real feel of joy about the place. You know, okay, you know, it's a place where they are looking after people who are sick and need care, and so there is a serious side of it, of course. But there's still a joy to it, a joy of actually giving to others, because actually, you know, fundamentally, that's where real joy comes from. You know, I like, there's a Dietrich Bonhoeffer line about this, that gratitude is the beginning of joy. You know, when we're really grateful for the blessings of life. And actually, a fundamental thing we should always be grateful for is actually being alive. You know, that's actually a gift from God. And it's something that God has given to us. And it's a beautiful blessing. And okay, we all know, we've seen people we love suffering and in pain, and that can be agonizing. We can't take away from that. But in being able to love someone, you know, there's nothing greater. There's nothing more joyful. You know, I think the greatest things in life are to love and to be loved in return. And we have that in God, in Jesus Christ, and we have it in our mission as Christians. So, you know, thank God for the Little Sisters, and I'm glad you had a great experience with them.
No, I really did. And I think it is actually important to say to those that perhaps fear for themselves or for a relative or for a friend, fear going into a residential home or a hospice. Actually, until you do open the door and until you do see really, really high quality care, where whether it's a sister, a care assistant, a volunteer, there's that desire to be alongside that person almost at all times, if that's what they want. If they want a bit more space, clearly that's respected too. But I don't think enough people understand what quality care looks like.
Yeah.
And for me, and I'm sure for you, that's after what you've just said, that's probably where the investment should be. It could
massively
be better. It is a bit patchy across the country.
Massively.
We should probably acknowledge that as well. We've
absolutely
seen these great, wonderful homes. They're not all like that.
No, absolutely.
So it would be better to invest more money there so people can have that care till the very end.
Yeah, and they deserve that. And it shouldn't be, I think I've heard this phrase, you know, it shouldn't be a postcode lottery about whether you're looked after in the end. It should actually be there for everybody. And I think that's a fundamental thing that we need to get right. I mean, that's what we need to look at is you know, proper palliative care and giving people that dignity that they deserve and actually is their God-given right. And we shouldn't forget that. You know, I think that's really important.
Couldn't have said that any better. So, yes, we need as many MP votes as possible. It was pretty tight last time, certainly a third reading. It was very tight. So I think, you know, this is, we would acknowledge this is a difficult issue. We know it is. But please do, if you agree with us and feel this way, stand up for human life at the very end.
Absolutely.
Contact your MP and please let them know how you feel. We'd certainly be grateful for that.
Definitely.
Now, talking of MPs, what about prime ministers?
We've
got a new one. We've got a new one, Andy Burnham. And much has obviously been made of his Catholic faith. I think, you know, obviously time will tell as to whether he champions those causes that we hold dear. But it was quite interesting, wasn't it, on sort of day one, on that Monday he was appointed PM, that he went to the passage a Catholic charity serving the homeless in Victoria, and did make that pledge to end homelessness in the UK. So from that sort of charitable Catholic social teaching aspect, there's clearly a connection there, isn't there?
No, absolutely. And it's wonderful that he began with that. And that should be heartening for us, that he has obviously taken to heart what he was taught in his Catholic education. So we hope that that's there in him. But that's wonderful that he did take that, because it's a massively serious problem in society. It's linked to many other problems that you need to address and think about, and I think that's important. And also, you know, we see it quite often in South London, and I'm sure around the country, but this phenomena of sofa surfing, you know, yeah. This thing of people basically staying on their friends' sofas because they've got nowhere to go. So it's not just actually about, you know, the ones that we see on the street, which are too many as it is, but also that hidden aspect of homelessness there. And I think it's heartening that he's got that. So, no, it's great. And I think it's great he started the Passage, which is a wonderful place, and I'm glad that that's where he began, and I hope it bodes well. And, you know, as people of goodwill, you know, whoever the Prime Minister is, we should hope they do well and they succeed. And I think it's something we should try and remember, actually, in this area, that, you know, so many people are like, oh, you know, it's another one, oh, it's going to be a disaster, whatever. Well, why not flip it a bit and actually say, well, let's hope he does well. You know, let's hope it goes well, because actually, if he does well, then hopefully the country's doing well, people are doing well, you know, people who need to be cared for and looked after will do well. So it's a good thing, I think, to actually hope the Prime Minister does well, whoever the Prime Minister is, you know, but let's hope that Mr. Burnham really does well. And he's got a good name, you know, so there's a priest I know called Andy Burnham. So, you know, it's a good pedigree, but we'll pray that he does well.
I think you've taken us towards the Ordinariate a bit there, have you?
Yeah, not? He is an ordinary priest.
indeed. No, I completely agree. And obviously, needless to say that we're looking forward to any work we can do with the Prime Minister and government on issues of shared concern. And I'm sure, you know, it's healthy to stand up against things when you don't agree with them. So there'll be swings and roundabouts,
as
they say.
It's a great line from St. Augustine that, you know, it's better to have a good friend who tells you the truth than an enemy who says sweet words. And that's paraphrased St. Augustine. So for anybody who loves St. Augustine, I apologize for paraphrasing. But that's basically a way of saying that, you know, it's good to be an honest friend rather than a duplicitous enemy.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, we're going to have a sixth Bishop of Arundel and Brighton. Father Stephen Wang,
fantastic.
Who I've known for many years.
What a fine man
that he is too.
Great.
I thought that was very good news.
No, it's great news. Great news for the church. I mean, particularly, you know, with his great work in catechesis, I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think that's really a wonderful moment in the church. I mean, it's great for the people of Arundel and Brighton. You know, they've got the bishop and they've got someone with passion and enthusiasm taking on that role. But I also think it's great for the wider church in this country that we're going to have a new bishop who is relatively young, as bishops go, which is great in itself. I'm not being ageist there, but, you know, it's good to have a bit of youth and enthusiasm, which is fantastic. But also with his work in catechesis, I think it's a real opportunity, and it's something that's really important at this time in, you know, when we talk about people coming back to faith and, you know, this quiet revival and so forth, that actually, you know, that we're sharing the truth of our faith and doing it in a way that people will understand, I think is really important. So it's great to have him as a bishop in the church in this country, and it can only bode well.
And I'm going to be a bit selfish, if you don't mind, working in communications. He definitely is a talented communicator. He's good at making those wonderful truths of the Catholic faith, the simple Catholic spirituality, the sacraments. He's really good at sort of being accessible with that and bringing that to people in a way I think they can comprehend, you know, without patronising anyone. I just think he's a talented communicator. So I'm certainly looking forward to the opportunity to work with him. And yeah, as you say, very good news. Now, he will be ordained the sixth Bishop of Arundel and Brighton on Monday the 19th of October at 12 noon. I think that's the feast of St. Philip Howard, which is obviously...
It is, and St. Philip Howard is there, actually, isn't he? I think the shrine of St. Philip
Absolutely.
Howard is in Arundel Cathedral, so it's an appropriate day.
Definitely. So you can check out abdiocese.org.uk. That will be live streamed there, but I'm sure we'll carry it as well on the Bishop's Conference website, cbcew.org.uk.
Wonderful.
Now, when we were talking about this podcast, you said to me, and I think you're absolutely right, I think it'd be worth talking about the deaths of two Catholic figures in public life.
Hmm.
Obviously, let's start with Anne Widdecombe.
Yeah.
Because obviously, Anne Widdecombe and Ed Sturton are the two people we would like to talk about. Ed Sturton obviously being a frontline broadcaster who died sadly at the age of 68 very recently. And Anne Widdecombe, who obviously we won't talk about the tragedy and the murder charges that have been brought, but we should really talk about an extraordinary woman, definitely polarized opinion, but had a strong Catholic faith. I certainly admired her. How about you?
An incredible woman. And as you say, you know, the circumstances of her death are tragic, and we shouldn't allow that to overshadow, in a sense, a remarkable woman who gave so much. And, you know, I met her a few times, and certainly one of the priests in my community knew her quite well. You know, there's incredible, Christianity in her, in a sense, that she was able to disagree with someone vehemently, but she had friends across that sort of political divide. And I think that's actually really good. You know, in a polarized age, someone like her, who was, in a sense, maybe we could say a polarizing figure for some, but actually in herself, she wasn't. She was able to have relationships with people across different perspectives and views. And I think that's really healthy. So I think that's a really good part of who she was. I think that's really a wonderful thing to reflect upon. I think some of the stories that have come out since she died, I really like. I really love that, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but that there was a possibility that she was going to be the ambassador to the Holy See, and that she was going to be sent off to Rome as the British ambassador. But she decided to do Strictly Come Dancing instead.
And I think,
I think that's fantastic.
But you know.
You know, I think it's great that, you know, someone thought, okay, I want to do something different. I want to try something different in my life, and I'm not afraid to do it. Hmm. And I think, brilliant. I think that's great that someone could actually think, no, I want to try something else. And I think so often in life we can just get into a rut and just go in a different way, that actually, you know, sometimes it's about embracing the richness and the fullness of life and going for it. And, you know, when you look at the lives of the great saints, you know, they quite often had lives that at different points they were doing lots of different things. And I think that takes real courage to do that. But the other part that I somebody sent me a clip of a speech that she made, which I thought was really interesting. And it was basically saying that no one has the right not to be offended, but also no one has the right to offend. And I think in the world we're living in today, it was really important because we need to be able to say what we believe. Not that we want to offend someone, but that I want to say what the truth I believe to be. So, you know, I want to be able to say Jesus Christ is Lord. Now, I believe that. I believe he is the savior of the world. I believe he's my redeemer. I think he's my best friend. You know, I believe that.
I'd have to banish you from the podcast if you didn't.
It'd actually be quite awkward if I didn't believe
it'd be
really
tricky.
But I do believe it. But if I say that, I'm probably going to offend someone. Now, I'm not deliberately seeking to offend someone. I mean, you know, far from it. I just want to say I believe this. Mm. But there's a likely chance that I'm going to offend someone with that. So I thought Anne Widdecombe's speech about this was really interesting. And I thought, yeah, she's right that, you know, we can't expect to go through life without being offended, because that's life, that's reality, that people believe. And, you know, I believe this, others believe something else. But I'm not seeking to offend in that. I just want to proclaim what I believe to be the truth. And so I thought that was a really interesting speech from her. So she's left, I think, a great mark on society. And if you think about her life in a sense as a Christian, you know, she was able to go to places and speak to people about Christ where I could never go. I mean, am I wrong? Was she on Big Brother? Was she on something like that? Or something like that? She was on some TV show that I would never watch, but, you know, but she was on something. And, you know, she was able to be there and articulate Christ in that situation. So a great example, actually, of evangelization, in a sense.
She was razor sharp.
Oh,
wonderful
absolutely.
Intellect.
Yeah.
But was prepared to do those pop culture things.
Yes.
And actually, pretty uncompromising in her views. But sometimes when you're like that and you sort of do it in love, or you're clear and, you know, you have a certain respect from people even if they don't agree with you. She called me, you're like this, when I interviewed her many, many moons ago, over 20 years ago, a stupid little boy. You can hear her saying it, can't you? You can hear her saying it.
That's not fair. You're not little.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Abbot Hugh. But the point is, was it a daft question I asked her? I think it was, pretty much. It certainly could have been a bit sharper, could have been taking us into more intellectual realms. And I think she just thought, I'll answer it, but it's a bit daft. And she let me know. And in the same way that someone else could have said that, and I could have been quite insulted.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, the firm teachers you had at school.
Absolutely.
You sort of think,
yes.
Actually, you've just given
me that.
Maybe
yeah.
You can't do it these days, but you've just given me an absolute mouthful.
Yeah.
And instead, I've thought, okay, what did I do to deserve that? Rather than, oh, you've hurt my feelings. I feel terrible about it. And she was like that. And I very much admire her for that.
Yeah. And then, you know, as you say, Ed Sturton, an incredible journalist. And again, a great advocate for the faith, you know, and but in a very different style. I mean, you couldn't, in a sense, almost have two contrasting characters since, you know, someone who was consummate diplomat in a sense in how he'd interview, and yet was obviously coming from a perspective of faith himself, but was really very good at bringing, you know, truth to light in how he'd interview. And he was always someone I think that was really interesting to listen to. He's one of those people I think had a voice that you'd like to listen to, but also that it was worth listening to. Do you know that he had, you know, that it was, he had a way of communicating that was really good. But you could obviously tell that he was courteous and deeply perceptive in how he behaved and spoke. And just a remarkable man. And when you think about the things he did, I think it was that he did a 3-part program on Catholicism. That was a great moment. And it was a really good insight into the church for people who don't know anything about Catholicism. So, you know, really great, great example.
And you know what? He was giving of his time, I have to say, sort of from a personal perspective. Not that I was director of communications at that time, but he's chaired a good few panels for us. You know, giving of his time generously, because I believe he thinks these are conversations and debates that need to be had. You're right. He was courteous. He was deeply perceptive. He was actually a really good journalist fundamentally.
Yes. And I think also one of those great journalists where it's very obvious what he believes and where he's coming from, but he wouldn't let that stand in the way of what he was saying, you know, that actually if his journalism took him to a particular route or point, you know, he'd go for it. And there was that sort of desire to bring things to the light, which is wonderful, really.
Yeah, it's that classic, I'm not a Catholic journalist, I'm a journalist who happens to be a Catholic.
Yeah, no, which is good.
I thought we would perhaps talk about the dedication of the new altar at Salford Cathedral, you with your Manchester connections.
Yes, I know Salford Cathedral very well. I'm many chrism masses there when I was a priest in our monastery in Manchester, and know the cathedral very well. I'd have to say, when I knew it, sadly, here's a phrase, it had been magnoliarized.
I know what you mean. You know what I mean? I'm of a similar age. I know exactly what you mean.
It had been painted over, and, you know, it still was a beautiful church and a beautiful building and a place of prayer and you know, wonderful in that sense. But you did feel, oh, gosh, this is a bit, you know, drastic. And seeing the photographs of what they've done, it's incredible.
Beautiful,
I mean, they brought a building alive. I sometimes say to people, if I hadn't become a priest, I think I'd have been an architect, because I love buildings. And I love the way buildings will speak to you if you let them. And you've just sort of go into it with an open heart, and a building will speak to you. It will tell you stuff. The sadness, I think, of, you know, magnoliarizing a place is it sort of obscures what it's trying to say a bit. What
dampens its voice.
Exactly. That good. Well, very good. I like that. Very good. That's good. But what they've done is they've sort of, you know, they've raised the volume again. And, you know, it's fantastic. It looks stunning. I can't wait to go and see it. But it looks really, really impressive.
That was nice. And obviously the nuncio, Cardinal Vincent Nichols, a number of our bishops, you know, lots of people there to celebrate. And it was the feast day of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, 16th of July.
Yes, which is I think she's the patroness of the diocese. You may get, you know, letters telling me that's not true, but I think she is the patroness. So you couldn't have a better day to do that on. So wonderful.
Well, look, we're nearing the end. I always try and get your view on our scripture slot. Obviously, we've got our biblical apostolate manager, Fleur Dorrell, that we'll catch up with in a second. And although we've already celebrated the feast of St. Mary Magdalene on the 22nd of July, we thought we'd ask Fleur to give us some insights into what the Bible and the church says about this extraordinary woman, possibly to challenge a few misconceptions as well. Any Mary Magdalene thoughts from you, Abbot Hugh?
Well, she is the Apostle of the Apostles, as Pope Francis called her. You know, she's someone that's very much there in the Easter story. You know, she's a great witness to the resurrection, that she sees the Lord. What I love in that story, though, is she doesn't recognize him at first. And of course, you know, she wouldn't have been expecting to see him, you know. You know, so that's part of it. But I think that's in our own life with God, our own pilgrimage, that sometimes we don't recognize the presence of Christ in our life. And we do sometimes need to step back and think, you know, the Lord's here, and that he is there for us, and he calls to us. Just as in the gospel passage, you know, he looks to her and says, Mary. Jesus does that for each of us every day. He's calling us. And I think it's a beautiful thing we need to remember and recognize him. And, you know, like St. Mary Magdalene as well, remember that there may be days when we feel that we've got it all wrong and that it's gone terribly badly wrong and we think we've done awful things maybe or whatever. God never gives up on us. If God's not give up on us, we shouldn't give up either. And remember that, you know, someone who perhaps was not thought well of by others was also one of the first witnesses of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if it's true for her, it's true for each of us too.
Well, what a lesson we can all take from that, absolutely. Well, as I said at the start of this podcast, we will take a month off in August, as we do, to accommodate the ghost town vibes of that particular month. Although I say that, it is festival season, isn't it? And I know you're going to be out and about. You'll be showing your face at a few festivals, won't you, of Catholic joy?
I am, yes. No, thank you, Jack. I've been invited to come to a few things. So obviously the Will Be Leave Festival coming up, but there's a thing called the Great Awakening, which I'm going to be speaking at in August. And at the end of August, various events in different groups. So, yeah, but in the middle, you know, a bit of downtime, you know, a bit of quieter time. My community has its retreat in August, which is a nice time to take some time to be quiet and to be still and to get ready for the autumn.
Is that in situ or are you going
somewhere?
Yeah,
we stay in the... It's easier. I mean, it's, you know, when you've got a community, it's hard to go somewhere. So, you know, the retreat giver comes to us and we just adjust the timetable a bit. And, you know, yeah, it's a good opportunity to really... I always think of it as a health check, really. You know, it's just where am I with God? Where am I with my vocation? You know, where can I be doing better? And I think that's a good opportunity for that. But I hope you have a wonderful August. I hope you
Thank
have
you.
A lovely time. Are you going away or are you...
I went away on what I might class as a rather difficult break. So I'm tempted to have something more relaxing, probably towards the end of August, I think, I hope.
Perfect. Go for that.
Just a little bit of time. Like
great.
You said, little sort of reset, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, change is good as a rest sometimes. So it's good to have that. But it's really important. I think we talked about this last time.
We did.
But it is,
we
know,
did.
It's really important to take time for that and look after ourselves, you know, because life is precious and we should enjoy every moment.
Well, I can't add to that. So, yeah, do have a very good summer.
You too.
We will see you and hear you in September, I do hope.
Please, God. If we're all still going, then.
Yeah. Please, God is right, I think. We'll just get on our knees and we'll hold that one in
Absolutely.
Prayer, shall we?
Yeah,
let's do that. Yeah. But for now, we will hand over to our Biblical Apostolate Manager, Fleur Dorrell, where we talk about St. Mary Magdalene and the Bible.
So, Pope Francis promoted Mary Magdalene's role as the first to witness Christ's resurrection and as a true and authentic evangeliser. And he raised her simple memorial to an official feast day in the Church's liturgical calendar. And a decree formalising the decision was published by the Congregation for Divine Worship on the 10th of June 2019, with an article explaining its significance.
Yeah, not very long then, really.
No, quite recently, actually.
Absolutely. And so what is the scriptural basis for this?
Well, it all hangs on Jesus' death. The first witness to Christ's resurrection, as all four gospel writers report, was indeed Mary Magdalene. Jesus sends her to the apostles to tell them he is risen, just as Mary brings Jesus' birth into our lives in her lifelong yes. So in her fidelity to Christ, both in life and beyond the tomb, Mary Magdalene becomes a model for every member of the church.
So is this why she's known as the Apostle to the Apostles?
Yes. So Mary Magdalene is finally taking her rightful place in history and as a beloved disciple and apostle of Jesus and as a prominent early church believer. But we've actually given her a really tough time over the centuries, since her name and reputation were so misunderstood that she was remembered more as a prostitute and seducer than as the first bearer of the good news.
And why do you think that is, Fleur? Why has she been so discredited?
Well, it's really quite complex, but in short, unlike most other women in the Bible, she is not identified in relation to another person, because she's not anyone's mother, wife, or sister. She's called Mary of Magdala, which implies she came from that city, a famous centre of commercial fishing on the northwest bank of the Sea of Galilee. And what we glean is that she left her home to follow Jesus and was among several fairly wealthy, independent women who may have financially supported Jesus' own ministry. And these female followers, who would also have been called disciples, became central to his mission. We think also of Mary and Martha and Joanna, the wife of King Herod's steward Chuza, who all supported Jesus financially as well as in their faith.
That's fascinating. So what's the next issue with Mary Magdalene, apart from her status then?
Right. So Mary Magdalene is confused with other women in the Bible, controversially with the unnamed sinner in chapter 7 of Luke's Gospel. Now, nowhere does it say that this woman was a prostitute. Nowhere is she actually identified as Mary of Magdala. The confusion may have risen from the proximity of that passage to the one that identifies Mary of Magdala by name, as a follower of Jesus, who had had 7 demons cast out of her in Luke chapter 8, verse 2, i.e. the next chapter, and also mentioned in Mark 16. Then it becomes even more confusing biblically, because this unnamed sinner gets conflated with another Mary, Mary of Bethany, Martha and Lazarus's sister, who also anoints Jesus' feet and wipes them with her hair, as described in chapter 12 of John's Gospel. And we celebrate the memorial, note not a feast, of this Mary, Martha and Lazarus, in this same month, on the 29th of July.
So in which case, do the other Gospels help our understanding of who Mary Magdalene is?
Not really, sadly, no they don't. Because in Matthew, this woman is a close friend of Jesus, rather than a stranger with a reputation as a sinner. Some scholars believe that the fusion of Mary of Bethany and Mary of Magdala arises not just because of the shared name of Mary, but from the parallel presence of the alabaster jar of perfumed oil in both their stories. Then we have that problem that the Bible provides us with so little information. We know that in the New Testament period, Magdala was a successful fishing and fish processing centre 120 miles north of Jerusalem, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. But in later Jewish texts, such as the Lamentations Rabbah, it is described as judged by God for its sinfulness and fornication. So it's quite plausible that its reputation was applied in later Christian writings to Mary Magdalene, its most famous inhabitant.
It's tricky, isn't it? It feels like we have to tread very carefully here, I must say. So, with a sense of trepidation, has Mary Magdalene's reputation been intentionally damaged, do you think?
Well, although Mary of Magdala's reputation as an apostle would have begun soon after her death, her transformation to repentant prostitute was actually sealed in 591 CE, when Pope Gregory the Great gave a homily in Rome pronouncing that Mary Magdalene, Luke's unnamed sinner, and Mary of Bethany were indeed the same person. In his homily number 33, he says, "She whom Luke calls the sinful woman, whom John calls Mary, we believe to be the Mary from whom 7 devils were ejected, according to Mark. And what did these 7 devils signify, if not all the vices? It is clear, brothers, that the woman previously used the unguent to perfume her flesh in forbidden acts."
Goodness me, that's pretty strong, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, tell me, why would Pope Gregory the Great have concluded this, do you think, Fleur?
Well, the most likely reason was actually to use the story positively, to assure converts that their sins would be forgiven if they similarly repented. They too could be transformed from their former life, no matter what that life was like. But by reducing one of the most important believers and key figures of the early church to a prostitute, he effectively, though unintentionally, restricted biblical role models for women to predominantly either Madonnas or prostitutes.
Goodness me. Well, I'm going to now use your big brain to segue from west to east. You mentioned earlier that it was in Western Christian thought that Mary Magdalene was constructed as a sinner. You know what I'm going to ask? What about Eastern Christianity? Do they agree?
Well, that's a great question, James. The Eastern Church took a very different approach. Here, she is honoured and celebrated for her witness to the resurrection, recorded in all 4 Gospels. So among Eastern Christians, Mary Magdalene is not a siren, another Eve and temptress, which the church and artists have so systematically embedded into our psyche. She's not just seen as a symbol of the human journey from sensuality to spirituality. She is an evangelist and a true disciple right from the start.
It sort of strikes me that both things can exist, really. I mean, it's a delicate one, but how best can we redeem Mary Magdalene's proper and accurate role within the Bible and in our church history as the apostles' apostle?
Well, Pope Francis began the way, so all credit to him. By reclaiming Mary Magdalene's proper and more accurate roles as apostle, witness, loyal believer, and early church evangelist, we will slowly begin to erode these injustices against our first witness to the resurrection, for whom there is no real evidence of a different sort of life. And we might want to reflect that when Jesus rose from the dead, he could have appeared to anyone. More commonly, it would have been to a man, regarded in Judaism as a more secure witness, or even perhaps to his own mother. So why does he appear to Mary Magdalene first? This speaks to us of how he regarded her and their unique relationship. If she is who he most wanted to appear to, how have we got her so wrong for so many centuries? Her reappraisal is a small start, but a necessary one, I think, and one that we can adopt more widely in our catechesis and especially on her feast day.
That's a wonderful rehabilitation of Mary Magdalene. I think you've sort of danced on the line a bit. You've given us chapter and verse, if you forgive the phrase.
I have indeed.
but you know what? Seriously, very thought-provoking. We do have that reverence, of course, and hopefully for all the right reasons. So, Fleur, if this is the last biblical apostolate slot before we reconvene in the autumn, thank you very much. And I think you've left us with quite a bit to ponder.
I hope so, James. I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you. And ponder we shall. Thanks very much to Fleur Dorrell, our Biblical Apostolate Manager. Now, we have a short but very positive message for our bishop's slot this month. As we mentioned a little earlier, we had great cause for celebration at the start of July when His Holiness Pope Leo XIV appointed Father Stephen Wang as the new bishop of the Diocese of Arundel and Brighton. Until then, Father Stephen was rector of the Venerable English College in Rome, one of two English and Welsh seminaries in the Eternal City, training men for the priesthood. Let's listen to Father Stephen's response to hearing he had been appointed sixth bishop of Arundel and Brighton.
I've been really surprised, as you can imagine, to hear about this appointment. There's a strange mixture of feelings, a sense of gratitude and trepidation at the same time. I'm excited and curious about what lies ahead. And beneath everything, there's a real sense of peace. I'm grateful to Pope Leo for appointing me and putting his trust in me, and to Archbishop Richard Moth for all his care for the diocese over these years. I'm sad to be leaving the Venerable English College in Rome and the Diocese of Westminster, which has been my home for so long, but I'm overjoyed at the thought of coming to Arundel and Brighton, getting to know the people and working together to build God's kingdom. Coming from a landlocked diocese where the biggest hill is no taller than a London bus, I'm really excited about doing some wild swimming and exploring the South Downs. I will need a lot of prayers and support. I hope that even with all my weaknesses, I can be a loving shepherd, a spiritual father, and a brother too. I know that if we put our trust in Jesus and Mary, and if we always try to serve and love one another, then we can't go wrong.
Bishop-elect Stephen Wang there, whose episcopal ordination will take place on Monday the 19th of October at 12 noon in Arundel Cathedral. That's the feast of St. Philip Howard. Very good news for the church, I must say. Okay, that's it for this episode of At the Foot of the Cross. Thanks, as always, for your time and for lending your ears, as the Beatles might say. Have a very restful and peaceful August, and we'll be back with you again in September. Bye for now.